tonight
on This Is Vinyl Tap. Love in the key of C. Set the sun on a big wheeled wagon. Shine your teeth to meaningless and sharpen them with lies.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another episode of This Is Vinyl Tap. I am your host tonight, Tony Slagle. And as always, I am joined by our normal host, Doug Cooper.
You're welcome.
And our very humble producer, Jonathan Jamro.
Good evening, Tapsters.
And we are in the Vinegaroon tonight, gathered to speak about the third album by the band Wilco, Summer Teeth, released on Reprise in 1999. And I'm just going to go right to the source and ask the person who picked it. Anybody who's listened to our award-winning Album Wars episode with Trace and Yankee Hotel Foxtrot realized this is probably not my pick. Doug, was this your pick?
This was not my pick, although I feel like all of the picks should be mine.
So that leaves one person. That's Jam. Jam!
That is me, yes.
Why did you pick Summer Teeth to talk about tonight?
Well, I've debated how I would couch this, so I'm going to just come right out and say it. I think this is a splendid pop album. And I think it's almost, it's pop art almost. I think it is a very good pop album.
And have we ever used the word splendid before?
I thought you were looking at him. Doug had a very confused look on his face.
I thought he was confused because it was a pop album.
Definitely not something to be confused about.
But I want to kind of go back and just, and give you guys a little bit of my background with Wilco. I was a huge Uncle Tupelo fan. And then I played in a band that actually got to open for Uncle Tupelo. And I got to meet Jay Farrar and Jeff Tweedy, the main guys in Uncle Tupelo. Well,
it was a trio.
It was a trio.
Jeff Tweedy is Wilco.
Yeah, Jeff Tweedy is Wilco, and Jay Farrar is the Sunvolt. The person that was actually incredibly nice, incredibly was shaking her hand and was telling us, "Yeah, thanks for opening." And it was just, yeah, and was Jay Farrar. So when
Mr. Personality,
according to he was probably not the easiest guy in the world to work with, given the history of where we're going to go with Wilco. But Jeff Tweedy was just the most standoffish guy in the world. So when the band split, I became much bigger. Just based on that meeting, I became a much bigger Sunvolt fan.
Well, and don't dismiss the fact that when those two debuts came out, AM and Trace, Trace was head and shoulders above AM in terms of quality of songwriting.
I bet JM felt like he didn't need to say that. I bet he felt like that would be said by someone else.
Sorry.
Trace was the Sunvolt album and AM was the Wilco
album. Was the Wilco album. And I really, really liked Trace.
You're with me.
I thought Trace was just one of
the... You weren't alone.
Yeah, I thought it was one of the greatest alt-country albums ever made. And I thought what I'd heard from AM just bored me.
I actually like AM a lot.
It's not as good.
AM is Wilco's first album.
It's their first album, yes.
To me, the first two Wilco albums... just didn't hold a candle to the Sunvolt albums. And so then I went to an REM concert and the opening act was Wilco, and it was Summer Teeth was about to come out. And
you saw REM in 99 or 98? Yeah,
99, early 99. Huh. Yeah. And so Wilco opened for him and it just sounded different. It didn't sound, I was expecting some sort of alt country sort of sounding deal, and it wasn't that. And they said, "Well, you got a new album coming out. It's." And then I read a review of it that said, "This is a pop masterpiece." And I went, "This is a pop masterpiece? What is it?" So I went and I just bought the album on a lark. Just went out and bought it. I could not stop listening to this album when it came out. Every song just somehow spoke to me. I loved the production of it. It was lush. And it's surprising to me that Wilco actually produced this album. There is no producer on this album other than Wilco.
Well, the record company gave him pretty free rein.
Yeah.
Up to a point. Up to their album after this.
Yeah.
Well, mainly because they weren't getting, the record company wasn't getting what they thought they were getting. Yeah. They gave him leeway because they thought they would produce hits. And for some reason, it's a head scratcher how this album wasn't a bigger album than it is, but
I don't know.
They didn't. And so that's why they let them kind of do what they needed to do.
Yeah. And we'll get to that when we talk a little bit more about that particular song that they really pressed Wilco to create. It's got a playfulness that other Wilco albums don't have.
Well, musically,
lyrically, it doesn't, but yeah.
It's not real playful.
It does sound a little bit more like these guys are having just experimenting in the studio and just having a good time doing it.
Why is it called Summer Teeth?
I have no idea why it's called Summer
Teeth. It's an old joke, but I don't know what the setup is. It's like summer something, summer teeth. That's why it's called that, but I don't know what the...
Do you know what the Urban Dictionary says about summer teeth?
No.
No.
That's bad teeth, some missing, some are black.
Oh, I got you. So there it is. That's what it is. I think that's what it is. It has to do with the play on some R.
Yeah. So yeah. That's why there's not a picture with teeth on the cover. That wouldn't be attractive.
There's a smiling moon.
They could get what's his face from
the Pogues. Yeah. Summer teeth.
The other thing I want to say about it, this album doesn't take itself as seriously as future Wilco albums. Themselves, even though this is the album where Jeff Tweedy said he started actually reading stuff, and he was reading something, he started writing lyrics down on
doing the lyrics before you do the tunes, being literary.
And
I bet he started reading the New Yorker.
So this is kind of portending what the direction that the group was going to go. It doesn't sound slick. It sounds very, I don't want to say experimental, because it doesn't necessarily.
It's not Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
It's not sounding. Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Do you think this is when Wilco started being Wilco?
Yes.
Yes. I think this is when Wilco identified himself.
I think what happened was the first album comes out and Jeff Tweedy is very conscious about wanting to appeal to the fans that they had for Uncle Tupelo. And I think he also felt like he had to prove something.
Right.
Because he, I mean, by the time Anodyne came out, they were, I think the songs were fairly evenly split. But early on, like that first Uncle Tupelo album, there's maybe three Jeff Tweedy songs and the rest are all Jay Farrar. Jay Farrar was the personality of that band, even though he doesn't have much of one. He was the personality of that band and a big one, a big shadow. And I think Tweedy was trying to do something with AM to say, hey, look, I can do this too. And then Trace kind of made him realize, you know what? I'm not going to be able to keep up with that if that's what we're doing. And so when Being There came out, there was a small shift, but it wasn't the seismic shift this was. And a lot of that has to do, I think, with Jay Bennett getting a little bit more freedom. Yeah. But also just this idea. I mean, there's some rootsiness to Being There. This album takes a rootsiness and smashes it over the head with a sledgehammer.
It does.
There's songs that sound baseline, they could be maybe even an Uncle Tupelo Jeff Tweedy song, but when you start smothering them in mellotron and piano and guitar loops and all that kind of stuff, well, it's gone.
Yeah, and Jay Bennett is primarily a guitar player. Is there a guitar solo anywhere on this?
Yeah, album? I think one or two.
But he's a very good guitar.
There's a lot of similarities between Wilco and Tom Petty. And I talked about it before. One is fairly simple chord progressions that are really, they become great, catchy, immediately accessible tunes. Yeah. Both those guys do that. And the other is they play like a band and the guitar supports the song. It doesn't jump all over and do flash, just like
Mike Campbell.
Mike Campbell doesn't interfere with the song, so everybody can see what a good guitar
player. But if you look at the stuff that came after this, the guitar solos became a center point of.
Well, by
Niels Klein is just a phenomenal guitar player.
Ghost is Born.
Yeah,
that turns into serious guitar noises.
I think it's the interesting thing about this album is that it's Wilco using, and we've talked about this with other bands, is Wilco using the studio as another instrument.
Right.
Yeah. And the one of the things about this particular album is they said that, I mean, the rest of the band said they just kind of cut their tracks. And then Jay Bennett and Jeff Tweedy just went into the studio and just overdubbed. They got hold of Pro Tools and just kind of went nuts.
Well, I think that's the common sort of story about this album.
Yeah.
But there's a little bit, and we'll get to that later, but there's a little bit of one of the band members who obviously was there says it's not entirely true. Like, that's the story that's been told. And a lot of that is because, and I wasn't aware of this, but until we started doing this album, but evidently Jay Bennett was very vocal about his contributions to this album, which is one of the things that rubbed Jeff Tweedy the wrong way and ended up kind of pushing them apart. I think almost to the point where he was the architect of that storyline, that it was me and Jeff, and there's some truth to that.
Yeah,
but and we'll get to it, but there's a little bit of, I think there's some nuance to that that's probably truer than it was just the two of them.
But we've mentioned this before in our Album War podcast of Sunvolt versus Wilco, but Jay Farrar and Jeff Tweedy came from a suburb of St. Louis.
It was across the river.
Across the river. Belleville? They're actually Illinois, Belleville. Yeah, okay. Belleville, Illinois. And they met, was it in high school where they started hanging out?
The story about them in high school is they were in a freshman English class, and one of the assignments was that you had to lean over to the person next to you and interview them, and then give a report to the class about that person. Tweedy didn't interview Farrar. We should do that. Tweedy didn't interview Farrar, but when the guy who introduced Jay Farrar to the class started talking, he said, this guy's favorite album is an album by some band called the Sex Pistols. And Jeff Tweedy, when the guy who interviewed Jeff Tweedy introduced him to the class, he said, this is a guy, Jeff Tweedy, whose favorite album is by the Ramones. And so Farrar and Tweedy were like, we're the only guys in this entire class, maybe this entire school, that are listening.
Maybe they
at least
city.
Felt that way. Yeah, yeah. We were listening to punk.
And there's a layer of irony there.
Yes, there
We've
is.
Only done two Album
yes,
War.
There is. There is a layer of irony. I thought about that. But my guy
Ladies
I picked,
and gentlemen, our other Album War was the Ramones versus
the Sex Pistols.
Sex Pistols. Yeah. I guess one liked Ziggy Stardust and the other one liked...
Hunky Dory. That's how they met. And they became, Ferrari even says there was a genuine kinship there. Like they got along early on.
Yeah.
They felt like this great quote from him. He's like, we were like visitors from Mars because nobody else. The other funny thing they would do is they'd go to the library, and this speaks to later on sort of their breadth of knowledge about music, particularly like Dust Bowl era music, because you're like, where the heck were these guys getting? So what they would do, and there's a little pretentiousness involved in this, they would go to the library and they would specifically pick albums that they knew other people probably weren't interested in, so that they could be the only people discovering this stuff. And so they discovered the Carter Family songs and all that stuff, and really got into that stuff. Plus, Jay Farrar is from a musical family anyway.
Jay Farrar has some musical siblings.
Yeah, Dade and Wade. Dade and Wade Farrar as brothers.
And they form a band
called the Plebes.
The Plebes.
That sounds like parents who just want to create confusion in their house.
It does. Yeah,
well, where did Jay come from?
Yeah.
Wade, Dade, and Jay.
Should have named him Jade.
Yeah. I think Jay actually is his middle name. I don't know what his first name is. But.
Jade. JJ.
But yeah, they had a band called the Plebes. And you know how Tweety ended up joining them? They were entering a Battle of the Bands contest, yes. and they needed a lead singer. They needed another high school student to fill out, because they were short. I don't know. Maybe there was like a certain number of high school students you needed in the band before you could join.
Yeah.
And so he joined. He was a rhythm guitarist, and by all accounts, not a very good rhythm guitarist.
Yeah.
But he ends up joining the Plebes, and sort of oddly enough, considering what his history is with Farrar later on and how self-conscious he was, he kind of takes the band over. He pushes them, because they were leaning towards rockabilly stuff. He starts pushing them to
towards
more punk.
Yeah.
He starts booking their shows. He takes over booking their shows and really sort of takes over the band. And Dade, who was, I guess, the leader at the time, it rubbed him the wrong way. So he ends up splitting.
Yeah.
And I think Dade was the bassist. So
yeah,
then Jeff Tweedy takes over bass which is what all rhythm guitarists do, right, Doug? They become bassists.
Well, if you're the second best rhythm guitarist.
Yeah. And then they add this guy named Mike Heidorn, who is the drummer and he ends up being the drummer later on for Uncle Tupelo and Sunvolt, but they changed their name to The Primitives.
There was another band called
Song by a 60s garage rock band called The Groupies. There's a song called Primitives. So they named themselves that. It's funny, it was spelled two different ways because they got business cards printed up and it was misspelled on the business cards. So in order to make sure that they got gigs, they would spell it different ways depending on who they're talking to. But it was Wade Farrar was singing lead. Jay was on lead guitar, Tweety was on bass, and Mike Heindorn was on drums.
And they actually had a pretty good run for a while.
Yeah, there's some pretty interesting video of them online that we'll post on the website of them playing. One video in particular has Tweety in a dress and some guy writhing around on the, I say stage, it was really just a kind of an area of the floor that was marked off, and he's covered in fake blood. I don't know what the heck's going on there. It's very strange stuff.
Well, maybe they're copying some of the punk.
Might have been Halloween. I don't know. You know,
did they bite the head off a bat?
No head biting.
They discovered there was another band in town called The Primitives, so they figured out that they had to change their name, and they decided upon Uncle Tupelo. There was somebody called Uncle Tupelo in a comic strip, and I think they actually befriended that guy. And so they adopted the name Uncle Tupelo. The guy who actually created the cartoon character, the comic character, just randomly chose two words out of the dictionary.
Uncle and Tupelo.
Uncle and Tupelo.
Well, and the The other kind of interesting thing about that is that
it's amazing how many bands have been named by dictionaries.
Yeah. There's one of my favorite 70s prog bands called Yezda Urfa was that way. They picked two names out of a dictionary and combined them, Yezda Urfa. but yeah, what also happens is that Wade is he's in college and he's struggling with his studies. So he starts, he's like, guys, I can't do this anymore. And then Mike Heindorn ends up like breaking his ankle or twist his ankle. And so the Primitives are also just kind of put on the shelf.
Yeah.
But then Tweedy and Farrar start going over to his house to practice. And then when Wade decides, hey, you know what? I'm okay on my schoolwork. I think I'd like to start this again. They're like, we kind of started moving. We moved on without you. And so they have this other band.
Yeah. They started writing songs together. And they were a little bit more in the punk sort of vein.
Yeah.
And so I didn't think that Jay's brother would be into it.
Yeah. And so Uncle Tupelo, recorded four remarkable albums, I think.
If there is a Velvet Underground for the alt country movement, I would probably be Uncle Tupelo.
With one exception, Anodyne, they would have been huge if they put out another album after Anodyne, because that album had put them in a position to where they were going to be
monstrous.
Yeah. Were they all over college radio? Where were they getting the?
Yeah, and word of mouth. I mean, there's a magazine named after their first album. I mean, it's named their first album's named after a Carter Family song, but there's a magazine named No Depression, because there was a. And remember, this is early days of the interweb, so there was a chat group called No Depression where it was mainly dedicated to Uncle Tupelo fans, and they would talk about Uncle Tupelo. So that was spread that way, and then when the magazine came out, it broadened to more Americana, sort of what they called alt country or
Americana.
Americana is what they call it now. No one called it that back then.
Yeah,
You're talking about meeting them. I have a kind of a funny story. I may have said this on the other episode when we were talking about the album war, but my wife was actually a huge Uncle Tupelo fan way before I was. I saw them twice before I ever really was into them. First time I saw them was in March of 91 at South by Southwest.
Wow.
Yeah, it was right after No Depression had come out. Huh. They were playing in the middle of a set. Like, they were playing their little 35 minute set in the middle of a showcase. And the drummer, Mike, came up to me. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I looked a certain way and asked me if I had anything he could smoke, if you know what I mean. And I didn't. So he moved on. But and then I saw him at the Student Union at UT they played there for probably the Anodyne tour. I don't think it was before Anodyne was released. I want to say it was around, maybe it was right before Anodyne was released, but it was around that time period.
Yeah.
It was probably actually before, because I think, now that I think about it, there wasn't a whole lot of people on stage, and that album, the band had expanded pretty.
Yeah, the band had expanded by that point. I think Lloyd Maines was playing.
Yeah, Lloyd Maines is on Steel on that.
Yeah.
So I just want to briefly talk about the album before that, which was called March 16, 1992. Yeah,
that's a great album.
All acoustic, produced by Peter Buck. Produced is probably
he just let them use his house.
Yeah.
And he gave it to them for free.
And it's originals and then a bunch of Dust Bowl era songs.
Yeah.
And it's great.
This man's invention that they call atomic power. We all in great confusion, do we know time or hour? When a terrible explosion may rain down upon our land, leaving horrible destruction, blotting out the works of man.
I mean, but think about this. Here's a band who's got two albums that are just full of country punk tinged tunes, who decide right when grunge is kind of getting its head start, you know what, I think we'll go in the studio and record an all acoustic album. and then of course, as we said, they come the Anodyne. And why are we experts on Anodyne if we ever end up talking about it, guys?
Because they recorded it here in Austin, Cedar Creek.
That's right. And who's on that album?
They opened for JM's band when
they did. And who did they duet with on that album too?
Doug Somm.
That's
great,
right.
Doug Somm.
And that was the album where they expanded their lineup to be
Greatest Doug from Texas.
There you go. Mike ends up leaving, and so they need a new drummer. They get Ken Coomer on drums. They get John
Strayett
on bass.
Because Jeff Tweedy wants to play guitar.
Right. Max Johnston, who's the kind of the early Jay Bennett, if you want to call him that.
Multi-instrumentalist. He went on to play with the Gourds.
Yeah, he's with the Gourds, exactly. I think he's from here.
He is from, and Michelle, he's Michelle Schacht's sister. Michelle Schacht's brother. Oh,
that would be shocked. Yes, I'd be shocked to find that out.
That can happen.
And then, that album to me is like the perfect distillation of everything that band was doing up to that point.
I think you're right.
They had kind of loosened the whole punk thing, but it's a damn near perfect album.
It is a damn near perfect album, and there are just some beautiful songs on there. And that duet with Doug Somm is where they do the Doug Somm song, "Give Back the Keys to My Heart."
Give back the keys.
Great. You know, it was weird when I saw after they broke up, and I saw both bands several times. I saw before on their tour for their first album. I think I saw Wilco maybe three times and Sunvolt maybe three times. Jay Farrar didn't sing that song, but Jeff Tweedy sang it every time I saw him. But he doesn't sing it on the album, but he sang it when they played live.
Right? Yeah. Well, supposedly there was so much friction going on on the last Uncle Tupelo tour, where Jay Farrar would not sing harmony or anything while
Tweedy was singing. Yeah, it's one of those things similar to what we talked about with Jellyfish, where one of the guys just decides he's done, and the other guy is kind of left scratching his head trying to figure out what the hell happened. One of the things that was interesting about their last tour, and we need to kind of wrap it up so we can start talking about who we're supposed to be talking about tonight, but was they played, I think, two nights at Mississippi Nights was where they wrapped up in a kind of legendary St. Louis place.
And they kind of were talked into doing that those last few shows.
Do you know what the very last song they ever played was?
No, I do not.
The End?
No. So Brian Henneman from the Bottle Rockets was a guitar tech for them. He's also on. I think he plays some guitar in Anodyne. He plays. He's the guitarist on AM. Yeah. But he ends up joining the guys on stage to sing "Give Me Three Steps."
That's the
last song. That's the very last song they sang as a band. And there's a video of it.
That's a Lynyrd Skynyrd classic.
And there's a Lynyrd Skynyrd song. Sorry about that. And there's a video of it that I will post on the website, which I think ends in kind of a sort of a melancholy note. I think Tweedy leans in the mic and goes, "Well, I guess that's it."
Jeff Tweedy, which is a big surprise to me, winds up taking most of that touring band to form Wilco.
I don't think Farrar wanted him. I think he was cutting ties with them.
I heard that nobody wanted to work with him.
Well, I can get that. I get that. But he cut ties with them because he's done that with Sunvolt too. Is the first iteration of Sunvolt was a remarkable band, and he cut ties with those guys.
Yeah.
I mean, the current iteration's good as well. But Tweedy immediately, again, I think, felt like this need to prove something. He went in the studio, had a bunch of demos, probably songs he was writing for Uncle Tupelo, and pretty much kind of rushed this album out, AM out,
which is a pretty good album.
I think it's unfairly maligned by people.
I don't know. I think it's
underrated. It's underrated. Box Full of Letters is a fantastic song.
You're coming.
still be your friend.
I got a lot of. I mean, the whole album's really good, but it's definitely, you can tell he's in the shadow, and he's even more in the shadow when, because we talked about this on the album wars when Trace came out. Brian Henneman, who was working on this album with them, went, "Oh, whoa!" They heard an early copy of it, and they're like, "We got to up our game," which is interesting because it might explain why Being There is a double album, and why
trying to get everything out.
Well, and it's also a bit of a movement away from that. It's the first kind of steps away from the whole alternative country stuff. When that album came out, I bought Being There the day it came out, and I put it. I came home first. It was a double album. I was like, okay, well, whatever. That seems a little pretentious, but okay. Yeah. I put it on. I like some of the songs, but then I got to Monday. And I was like, oh, this sounds like the Stones.
It really, really does.
And I was like, uh-oh. Yeah. And I'll be honest with you, I think I'd returned it. I think I'd return the album. I was like, this isn't my cup of tea. Now, that was a young me. And I know people who listen to this podcast know that I'm very opinionated about stuff. But I've listened to that album since then. And it's not fair for me to say that's a good album.
First album that Jay Bennett was on where... they start switching instruments around.
Yeah, because he joins the band during the AM tour. Because right. He was with a band called Titanic Love Affair. They were like a power pop band through the lens of the Replacements, right. Essentially.
Yeah.
He's hired on as a live guy, and then by the time this Being There is done, he's kind of a full-time participant at that point.
There was a piano somewhere around, and Jay Bennett started playing it, and Jeff Tweedy just went, man, we could really up our game if we had a keyboardist in our band.
Here's the interesting thing about that album, too. He wanted it, he insisted on it being a double CD, but he wanted it priced as a single CD. So he took a cut in pay so that the label wasn't going to do it. And he said, okay, I want to take it. So he took a royalty cut. And they priced it around $18 instead of $30 is what they probably would have priced it at. But I forget how much money he took a pay cut for. But I read one of the product managers for Reprise said that he thinks Wilco lost about $2 against any future royalties. So for every album sold, so that by 2003. That amounts to about $600,000.
Jeez.
That he gave up to just so he could do this. He had an idea in mind of how he wanted it sequenced, all this stuff. And he even said at the time that, you know, and this is the thing with double albums. He said, I had one album in mind, but the songs just kept coming.
All right. So that brings us up to this album.
Well, yeah, I mean, they start recording this album. And where did they start recording this album? With Summer Teeth.
Summer Teeth, they started recording it at Willie Nelson's studio, Spicewood. Studio. Yeah,
Spicewood. Yeah. If you think it's in Austin, you should drive there at 5 o'clock.
Jay Bennett and Ken Coomer had played on in the studio there in Spicewood on a session with a guy named Jeff Black. I don't know who that is.
Yeah, but I don't know either.
They fell in love with it, and so everybody talked Tweedy into coming in and using that studio to start recording this album. Yeah,
and he was familiar with the place.
And that's when that's actually, you know, the story is that they go to Chicago, and Jeff Tweedy and Jay Bennett create this soundscape of pop stuff. But they start experimenting with the studio there, but they found a Maestro Rover guitar effect. It's essentially a guitar effect that mimics a Leslie amp.
Oh, really?
So if you want to explain what that...
Well, a Leslie amp is... The Leslie speaker cabinet has a rotating...
Like a horn, right?
It's like a horn is what they call it. Yeah, it's like two horns attached to each other, and it spins around, and that's where the sound comes from. Yeah, so, and you can control when you control the speed, that kind of gives it this sort of, yeah, whomping effect, I guess, or a
They call it the Doppler effect.
Doppler effect. I can see. Yeah. So it gives it this kind of unusual sounding
blue red. It almost sounds.
Kind of sounds dripping, but it's used a lot with Hammond organs.
Yeah,
that's probably where it gets it. So when you hear a Hammond organ and a guy just hitting a single note or a single chord on a Hammond organ, and it does that kind of pulsating sound, that's from the Leslie cabinet.
One thing we got to mention is that Max Johnston isn't with the band anymore.
That's right.
He gets fired because essentially I think Jay Bennett muscles him out.
Is that right? Yeah. He wanted to play with some of those instruments.
Well, he was, I think when they were recording Being There, he felt more and more like he wasn't being utilized.
Jay Bennett is making personnel decisions in Wilco at this point.
He's muscling his way into being more of a
force to be much more a driving force in behind Wilco. And he's being aided by Jeff Tweedy because Jeff is figuring out that not only is Jay Bennett a really good guitar player, he's an exceptional keyboard player. Brief history about Jay Bennett. He was a pretty smart guy, and he was teaching math in public schools outside, in someplace in Illinois.
That doesn't sound smart.
And he was playing guitar and doing on the sides. Well, he wanted to have a collection of guitars, but he was discovering that guitars were really expensive. And this is in the late 80s, early 90s. And he discovered that people were getting rid of their vintage keyboards, like synthesizers, Mellotrons, Fender Rhodes, Wurlitzers. So he was just amassing this collection of keyboards and was actually becoming pretty adept on them. Jeff Tweedy discovered that Jay Bennett could actually play keyboards. He got really excited about that, and he started kind of formulating, hey, we can put keyboards in the band. Not only do we have to have piano, we can have all sorts of different sounds coming out.
I think it's a really gutsy move for Tweedy to essentially say, I'm going to start over.
Yeah.
I mean, that's essentially what he did. He said, I got this fan base.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're comparing me. And I'm sure that was a pain in the butt being compared to Sunvolt all the time.
Yeah.
But, and I'm sure it was a pain in the butt for Farrar as well. It's like, why can't we just do what we're doing? But
yeah,
it's gutsy, man, to basically say, there's going to be I was one of these people. I was diehard Sunvolt. Well, I was a diehard alt country guy at that point. So the idea of one of my bands going off and doing something else, as much as I'm a pop guy, really rubbed me the wrong way. It's a pretty gutsy move to do that.
So they started recording the songs
in Austin.
And then they got the call from Billy Bragg
to early '98
to make this Mermaid Avenue album with Billy Bragg.
Explain what the impetus between
It was Woody Guthrie's family discovered a whole bunch of lyrics that Woody Guthrie had never put music to, or at least they didn't know if he had put music to it. So it's the words of Woody Guthrie, and Billy Bragg was given the words, and he said, well, I got to put a band together and make these words into songs. And so he heard Wilco, called Wilco up. Jeff Tweedy kind of ran with it and said, hey, we can turn this into something. You know, we've been rehearsing. We've got this. Yeah, let's do this. Became a pretty popular album. Well,
they did three albums.
Yeah.
They released Mermaid Avenue, which is the name of the street I think they lived on in Coney Island.
Yeah.
The Guthries lived on, and then Mermaid Volume 2, and then they combined, they released a whole combination with another volume on it.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting story, though, that I found out. Evidently, Bob Dylan, I'm talking about, was contacted by Woody Guthrie before he died and asked Dylan to do that. He said, can you take these lyrics I have and do something with them? And so he shows up at Woody Guthrie's house, and his wife is not there. I'm guessing Guthrie wasn't either. Maybe he'd passed by this point by the time Dylan showed up. But the only people there were Arlo Guthrie and the babysitter, and they had no idea where any of these lyrics were. And so he left, and so it ended up being a Billy Bragg Wilco thing. I just imagine how different it would have sounded.
After this album, after the Mermaid Avenue thing, Jeff Tweedy and Jay Bennett just became simpatico. They both kind of had a similar vision for where they wanted to take the next album, Summer Teeth.
I think that was helped out by the fact that they lived in Chicago and the other two guys didn't.
Yeah.
And so they were very insular in what they were doing.
Right.
And they were working on Summer Teeth without the rest of the guys' input because the rest of the guys weren't around.
Right.
But didn't they have something else in common?
What was that, Doug?
Maybe some
substances.
Substances?
Yes. They were both, I think, really heavy into prescription drugs at that point.
And like Vicodin, Percodin,
and not only that, at this time, Jeff Tweedy was not having the best relationship with his wife. Luckily, they're still together, but yeah, the lyrics were.
If I was his wife, listening to these songs, it'd be a little tough to stick with the guy.
Well, supposedly he ran all of them by her before he recorded this album.
Well, one of the reasons he says he wanted them layered the way they are and to make it sound, which is really what makes it kind of interesting and compelling, is that he said, I can't listen to this stuff, so I need to drown it out by something else. So he drowns it out with this studio pop.
Mimicry, yeah.
Yeah, stuff going on.
He really wanted to experiment with the studio, and he found kind of a kindred spirit in Jay Bennett, who had just amassed all this collection of keyboards and was really anxious to start using them.
Well, he even said when he's first, after he'd written all the lyrics, because he said he stopped smoking pot and that's when he started writing the lyrics.
Yeah.
That once he looked at them, like, I guess he put them aside and looked at them, maybe put them aside. Or maybe it was when they got back to Chicago after recording the demos in Austin and he wanted to start over. He's like, this is so, like, like he's just opening himself up to everything. But, you know, that's when the idea came to smother him and
and
honey, if you will.
Yeah, supposedly the only lyrics that his wife had the problem with.
She's a jar?
She's a jar. The last line of She's a Jar is the only line.
Well, I don't know. What's the song where he talks about murdering her too,
and Viva Chicago.
Right. Viva Chicago.
Yeah, I think both of those, but I'd have a little bit of an issue with.
I don't know. It's just we need to open our minds.
I mean, I think it's worth talking before we start talking about the songs just a little bit about the fact that it's another. We haven't talked about this in a while, but it's another album drenched in Mellotron.
It is, and that's one of the instruments that Jay Bennett had acquired. So it is.
It's also a drinking.
It's a drinking game.
back when we said the drinking game, Mellotron was one of the
Yeah, we haven't
triggers.
Talked about the Mellotron in a while, but yeah, this one is steeped in Mellotron.
Yeah, and it's a little bit unusual for a band of this sort of, I don't want to say caliber, but this mentality. Like, they're an indie band. It's not, I mean, you know, Mellotrons weren't exactly hip.
It's a little late for a Mellotron.
Yeah, they said they first got, they got introduced to what it could do. They were in Mitch Easter. They're in Mitch Easter's studio, and he had a Chamberlain, which is, I think, like a precursor
to the Mellotron.
And they dug it, and so they're like, "We got to figure out how to work this thing into our music."
Yeah. Well, if our marvelous listeners want to know more about the Mellotron, they can go to the Moody Blues.
There's a great video
on the Moody Blues part of the website.
Yeah.
Our website with the Moody Blues.
Yes, tappingvinyl.com. When I was talking about the fact that the story has always been that this is Tweedy and Bennett holed up in the studio creating magic. How do you say his last name?
Striat
says that in truth, Jay Bennett had a fairly narrow musical palette. It was like Elvis Costello, The Clash, kind of that late 70s UK stuff, and that what people neglected remember is that when they were working on this album, the the Beatles anthology stuff came out, so they were listening to that nonstop. They were also listening to the Left Bank and Odyssey and Oracle, and the other guys in the band. So those guys were really into 60s pop as well. So they kind of influenced wanting to do it. And he ends up moving to Chicago to be closer to Bennett and Tweedy to be able to work on stuff. I think Coomer. He's the one that has a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, he's the one who's got a major. He didn't like his contribution. He thought he was getting muscled out.
Well, there was one song, I don't remember which it is, and I may have it in my notes, but there's one song where Bennett puts the drums down on it.
Well, he puts the drums on two songs.
And Coomer comes up and overdubs his drums over that. He takes Bennett's drums off and puts his drums back on. Yeah. So there's a little bit of infighting going on.
Yeah, and I've seen Ken
this
Coomer.
This reminds me of the Beatles when Paul McCartney starts playing drums.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
Ken Coomer's a great drummer, by the way. He's one of my, I've seen him play live a couple of times, and one time with Uncle Tupelo, and the second time, I think it was some band opening for the Bottle Rockets, and he was phenomenal.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh.
So, yeah, Summer Teeth comes out in November of 1999, or it's completed in November of 88. It comes out in 99, released in March of 99.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think Tweedy was really frustrated with, we touched on a little bit, was the whole pigeonholing them as an alt-country band. He didn't want to be pigeonholed anymore. Right. I think he felt like being there kind of moved them out of it. And I think he felt like, and when you listen to that track on Mermaid Avenue, I think he felt like Mermaid Avenue might have moved them back towards that direction. Like people started thinking them again.
Yeah.
Of them as that. So he really wanted to kind of
do something completely.
Stand on the mountaintop and say, this is not us. And there you go. So that's when the studio becomes an instrument, and he's got this guy who's a willing participant to kind of help him.
Yeah. And they're just getting to know Pro Tools. Pro Tools is one of the first and most popular computer recording interfaces. So it's basically allows you to do a whole bunch of stuff on the computer. You record directly into a computer. Like if you play a keyboard instrument on a song, you can actually change if you were playing organ, you can make it sound like a piano later.
Yeah, because they were...
It's software.
It ain't analog.
It ain't analog.
Before this, they were kind of alive in the studio band, and this changed everything. And of course, they doubled down on the next album.
They did, yeah. They went nuts on the next album.
Yeah. I thought about this a lot when I was listening to them. When you listen to any of the demos, they sound so primitive.
Yeah, they do. Really
I don't want to say raw. They sound primitive.
Yeah.
And I don't know how once they layered all this stuff on, I don't think they were thinking necessarily like, how are we going to do this live?
Yeah.
You know, when we talked about Jellyfish last week, those guys were cognizant of the fact that they were going to have to produce what they were doing live, and they really worked on it. I don't think Wilco even considered that at all.
And I saw them on this tour, and they had a coterie of people up there playing.
No Mellotron, I'm guessing.
No Mellotron, but a stack of keyboards.
Mellotron's got to be a tough thing to travel with. I would think it gets out of
Oh, yeah, the Mellotron is...
Especially when you have alternatives.
Yeah, it's the Mellotron, the tapes, if it's hot, if it's humid, the tapes get either jammed or they get elongated, so you're not really sure if you're actually playing the right note. Yeah. So,
but
just a little easier than taking a symphony orchestra with you.
So we're about to talk about Summer Teeth, and it's an album that's intriguing in the sense that it really is this sort of sugary pop, isn't maybe the right term, but this pop sheen over these fairly dark and bleak lyrics from time to time. And it's a very interesting thing when you're sort of there bopping around and then you hear a line, you're like, whoa, a minute. it's unsettling sometimes. But anyway, so... All right, everybody. So we are now digging into our album tonight. Again, Summer Teeth by Wilco. First song on the album or CD is Can't Stand It. Suits yeah, got a hold of it. Talked Tweety into coming up back into the studio to edit it down.
Yeah.
I think they took part of the bridge out.
Yeah.
Added the bells, did some other stuff. I know why they picked this song, because
it almost sounds like an outlier from the rest of the
album. It does. And it doesn't sound, here's what I'll say about the song. And this is what I'll say about Wilco in general. Even the songs I'm not crazy about, and this is one of them, they're earworms. Song will get stuck in your head, and it'll get stuck in your head all day long.
And even the lyrics, even though I don't really understand the narrative that he's going through on this particular song, they grab you. Love is random as God's love.
Yeah, and then he yells he can't stand it.
Yeah.
That's a theme with him. He obviously doesn't believe in God, and he's constantly angry with him.
Yeah.
How does that work? You can be angry with somebody you don't believe in.
Well, it happens a lot.
It happens to a lot of people.
But his
especially
that's,
in art.
That's I'll get into this later, but one of the things that I finally cooled on Wilco is I just couldn't deal with the subject matter more than anything else.
Well, half the time I don't even know what the damn subject matter is.
I can tell what, I may not be able to precisely say what he's talking about, but I can tell where his worldview is and what his mind's about.
Yeah, and okay, that's fair.
He's depressed, he's angry, he's lonely, and he does a good job of blaming himself, but he also blames outside too.
Right.
And when you read his lyrics, the thing comes out again. Even though this is the tune doesn't sound sad.
That's the thing. To me, that's the thing about this album. It sounds to me
like, hey, here we go.
Sounds like the Beach Boys.
I was about to say, I wish it is, Brian Wilson was writing happy words. Good to your school.
It is a bit of an outlier, but it also is different enough to where it's a good way to say, hey, whoever's a Wilco fan, we're doing something a little different right now.
I'll agree with you there.
I'll say this about the song. This is why
I was so surprised when I heard this.
This is the thing that kind of gets me about this song. So I love the way it starts off, and I think the chorus is great, but this whole little kind of groove they get into, that's, to me, that's uninspired. That sounds like almost everything that bands in 1999 that were of this ilk were doing. It does not sound that different.
To me, it sounds like a 70s disco almost.
No, it sounds like something like, I don't know. It just seems that
the bass is amazing on it.
The bass is fun.
So, I mean, it's I don't want to knock it because it is, like I said, it's an earworm, but it just sounds, I don't know, it sounds uninspired. And that may be.
I agree with it. It doesn't sound, it does sound a little bit manufactured. It sounds like they were building this from the ground. Okay, we got to have a hit song, and want us to do it.
Here's something interesting about Tweety, and he admits this. He's like, you know what? Because they gave me artistic freedom, I was willing to go in and do what they wanted me to do. I didn't consider it selling out because they gave me what I wanted. He goes, I could make the album I wanted. If they wanted me to come in and tweak a song to try to get a hit off of it, I'm happy to do it.
This record is filled with happy, fun, exciting songs that aren't talking about happy.
No, that's the weird thing about it. And it's
there's a couple of parts. There's a part where and we'll get to it, but there's a part in the middle where I think it does start getting.
Well, there's some songs that
the subject matter matches the next one, but
I think you're right though, Doug, and that's one of the things, like I said, that sort of makes this album interesting. I get what you're saying though about how you cooled on them because the subject matter is a little rough. I get that too, but I don't know. I find it kind of fascinating to listen to this stuff and be like kind of in my head about, man, this music is really bouncy and fun. Mm-hmm. Boy, these lyrics are just bleak.
yeah, it is. A strange dichotomy, but I think
it's an interesting one though.
Well, I know. I think that's one of the things that kind of it has going for it is that it is like, hey, I'm this happy looking guy and look how, but inside I'm actually a psychopath. You know, it gets that kind of social, I don't know. To me, it gets that kind of psych. Yeah.
I just think he said, no, I don't think he's any of those things. I just think he's a narcissist.
Huh.
No, maybe he's not.
I don't think he's a narcissist.
You know, he does love talking about himself.
Well, what's interesting, I read an interview with him where he was trying to understand why he was in the headspace he was, because he said, it was at a point in my life where I was surrounded by more people that showed me love than any other time in my life, but I was significantly lonely. I mean, he had a kid, mm-hmm. he had a wife.
All right.
His wife, obviously, was a saint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean,
even now she looks like she's a freaking saint.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't, it's just weird. He's one of these.
It just seems like all of these songs are conversations with himself.
Which I don't really have a problem with.
I don't either. But what?
I mean, Jackson Browne's the champion of having conversations with himself in his songs. Uh-huh.
But his songs aren't about beating his wife or killing his wife.
It seems like he's constantly putting a spotlight on himself, and I think that explains a lot of his unhappiness.
Yeah, maybe.
And. But I would also like to add, I'm an idiot for trying to diagnose somebody from 1,000 miles away just based on songs I listen to. Yeah.
But
I'll be the first to say that.
I mean, he's talked openly about the lyrics on this album, and he said,
and he is the most self-deprecating person.
I know, that's true, but it's still self.
Yeah,
right. That's true.
But the other thing he says about this is that you know, obviously, he's never hit his wife. He's never done any of this stuff. But it's a fictionalized way of him to delve into this, like, darker side of his psyche.
He was reading a lot of fiction. And
yeah. What's his name? Henry Miller?
Henry Miller.
He's reading a lot of Henry Miller. That'll do it to you.
Yeah.
Anyway, we probably should talk about the next song before we start talking about wife abuse.
All right. Next song, She's a Jar.
Lyrically, I think this is one of his best songs.
This is my favorite song on the album.
Really?
It is a very, very good song.
I think it's almost perfectly realized. When I first got this record, I never listened to it once. And I'm profoundly disturbed at the idea of hitting a woman. At one time, I might have gotten into an argument with my little sister when I was a young man, and I might have grabbed the Austin phone book and hit her with it.
Well, that must have hurt.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that now for two reasons. One, there's no longer a phone book, and Austin phone book is too huge to hold. But this is at about 350,000 in Austin. And my dad made it so perfectly clear to me that you would never, never, ever, ever hit a woman. I can't put into words how clear he made that. The idea of hitting women, men hitting women, just grosses me out. I can't even stand watching women hit women, like in that
I know, fighting
deal they do on the ESPN.
Yeah. This is your favorite song.
I love the tune. I love his voice on this.
I love the keyboards, the Mellotron comes all over that, and it's.
I feel like his vocals on this are the oral equivalent of watching syrup being poured out of a bottle.
Well, delicious, it's
just
delicious.
No, syrup. just like, okay, I'd like some syrup on my pancakes.
To me, it's confessional. To me, he is talking to himself.
I'm not talking about the subject matter. I know, but
the way that he's delivering
talking to himself once more.
I'm talking about the delivery is. I think the delivery is perfect. I like the song in spite of itself. I'd find his vocals to be drony.
Well, and I think it's effective. I feel like it's almost surrendering.
This is one of his best. Lyrically, it's one of his best songs he's ever written.
I think the tune is very attractive, and I think his resignation and all of that, even though it's 1,000 miles from how I feel.
I know. It's 1,000 miles from how I feel the exact same way. And the last line, she begs me not to hit her. I mean, that just...
I've heard an a possible explanation for that.
Which is what?
And I don't know if it's true. She's a jar with a heavy lid.
Mm-hmm.
How do you open a jar?
You bang on the lid.
Bang it on the lid, yeah.
So maybe she begs me not to hit her means she begs me not to open her up and get all of the whole. I think the whole song's about
trying.
She
to get
doesn't come out. He can't get her to
right,
express
and that's herself. That's one of the things that I think you're talking about is vocal delivery. I think that's part of it. He's just so freaking tired of this, and the way that
I'll have to listen to it again. But it just it takes me.
If you think about a jar with a heavy lid, is I can't get
right
her to open up
right,
and maybe he's talking about you know how you take the jar and you bang it
with a knife or whatever.
Yeah, and I do believe that he's also shocking people on purpose. He says he doesn't do that. But I don't think you can be so detached from the world that
I don't think you can end it. You cannot say the last line of a song, she begs me not to hit her, and not go in for the shock value. You have to be doing that.
That surprises me.
Yeah.
And I don't like that.
I don't like the sentiment at all, but I think it's the way that he's...
She begs me not to...
But somebody who has been in a... Yeah, we've all... Well, maybe I've been more of them than you guys have, where you just can't get someone to talk to you, and you're just so frustrated, and you're just so tired.
Usually the people I'm with are struggling to talk over me. That's been my experience.
Yeah, the next song is
something completely different.
Shot in the arm.
And now for something
completely different.
What's the name of the song?
He has a lot of songs where he does it.
Yeah.
Like a war on war.
Yeah. Where he repeats the same line over and over and over again. This is the centerpiece of the album, I think. And it is one of the... This is the song that just drew me into this album where I could not stop listening to
it. This is the first song that I actually am engaged in. Listen, we've talked about this in the past. I'm just a shallow guy. I hear a bouncy pop song and I love it. So what can I say?
It is a bouncy pop song, and the synthesizers are amazing.
Well, yeah, they've got that.
I would like to separate the idea of great pop songs from superficial thinking, because Little Steven said it the best. A great pop song is the hardest thing to write.
Right. Yeah.
Anybody can talk about
can you imagine Jim Steinman trying to write a 2.5 minute pop song?
This song was co-written by it's Bennett, Tweedy, and
Strayed.
This is
you can write about a long, complicated lyrics about a mouse with an underbite, but it's not as good as a pop song.
This is the one that Ken Coomer came in and overdubbed Jay Bennett's drums on. He had a death in the family, so he couldn't lay his drum tracks down. So Bennett
did. But the drums are amazing. But the timpani.
Well, yeah, he's got that. This is what we talked about last week on the Jellyfish thing. He's got that Beach Boys boom boom all throughout this song. You know,
yeah.
Is this the song you were alluding to when we were talking about New Mistake?
Yeah, it was.
Is this the closest to Yankee Hotel Foxtrot that they get on this
record? I think it is, as far as like the oral quality of it, because it's got everything that Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
It doesn't have weird noises.
Except it's a song.
It does have the weird noises.
It's a song.
It's a song. That's true.
The difference between,
but it's got that,
that's the difference between the album.
The end of the song. Think of the end of the song where it goes like all that.
You're right. Yeah. I can't get the part where you think there's not songs on Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. That's what's. makes my head explode.
But I can understand what this is a verse chorus song, and it is a perfectly pop structured song. I mean, I don't think there's a bridge, but it's got the happy keyboards going through it. It's got I think it's got a 12 string guitar in it even, so that gives it a little bit
It's a great song. It's a song where I'm like, okay, I'm okay now.
Yeah,
I've got it.
And one of the things I like about this song and I'm a sucker for this, every verse instrumentally sounds different.
Mm-hmm.
And how you can pull that off is always amazing to me, where you don't it doesn't detract from the song. It actually brings you into it.
Mm-hmm.
That's remarkable to me.
Moving on to the next song, We're Just Friends.
This is the sparsest song. This is all the instruments are played by Jay Bennett on this one.
I feel about this song this way you do, Doug, about Cheese a Jar. I think this song is absolutely compelling.
Really?
I think it's a very compelling song as well.
He sounds so vulnerable when he's singing this song.
Yep.
His vocals are perfect on it. It's one of the songs where the music doesn't necessarily mask what the lyrics are talking about. It adds to them in a way I think it's absolutely effective. It's heartbreaking. It's a great song.
This song caused me to have a connection, and I was a little disappointed that I wasn't hosting tonight. It's all right. It's a small thing. Because I wanted to ask myself this question. Who does this sound like?
Who does this sound like, Doug?
Well, thank you for asking. But who do y'all think Jeff Tweedy sounds like? And this Jeff Tweedy particularly, he really don't sound like anybody, except I cracked a code on this and I found out who he sounds like.
Well, this song makes
me... The voice.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Who?
This is a weird one.
Okay.
Dennis Wilson.
Okay.
On his album.
That's a great album.
Ocean Blue. It's bizarre.
Really? I've not listened to that album. So
I've been listening to it lately, and
that's a good album.
The way that Dennis Wilson lost his voice, because he's got this rough, weak voice.
Mm-hmm.
Because of behavioral problems. And I've been listening to this Wilco record and listening to that deal at the same time. And my brain just went, whoa.
Yeah.
I said, that's the closest I've ever heard to someone sound like Jeff Tweedy. And it's so interesting. And this song particularly makes that stand out.
This song reminds me of an album that I'm not exactly fond of, but it reminds me of it because it has that same sort of, this sheen to it, but there's cracks lying underneath the surface, and it's Big Star's third album Alex Chilton is kind of falling. He's having a breakdown, essentially falling apart when they're recording.
The vocals are pretty similar.
And it reminds me, that's a hard album to listen to. And everybody loves that album mainly because of that. A lot of people like watching a car wreck.
Cave deal.
That's what this reminds me of, because it's so vulnerable. Nick Drake. Yeah.
I do that all the time.
But it's, I knew who you were talking about, but, that's what it kind of reminded me of, was that kind of feeling I get, although I like the song significantly better.
Well, I'm a sucker for this is a piano ballad.
Yeah.
And it's not it's not an Elton John piano ballad. It's simple and it's
and clean.
And given what I know about how this album was made, the context helps. You're just wondering, is he really having to say this to his wife that we're just friends? Or
how old was he when he was making this record?
Oh Lord, he was in his
early 30s.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Really? Are you sure about that?
Yeah, in 99, because he's my age. He's okay. Almost exactly my age.
Okay. Then there's this.
It's such a mismatch for some of the lyrics in the song, like throttling your sweet,
yes.
I mean, we're talking about choking people, or I guess his wife. I don't know who he's choking, but it sounds so happy.
Musically, it sounds like a song the Fountains of Wayne could have done.
It does. Really does. Yeah, yeah. That's a great.
It's got that same spirit that you'd expect with about the kids, the 10 kids on their bikes.
And well, I mean,
love it. Yeah. I mean, that, what is that that comes in going, wee?
That keyboard. It's like, keyboard, yeah, it's like, yeah. It's almost.
That portamento keyboard.
I wonder what they, I can imagine
and someone that, doing that. That Fender.
Bennett does that. Now I can hear everybody going, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, no, this song, musically, this song is just so much fun.
It's so that compelling.
That pounding, yeah. It keeps...
And it comes right after, like, that piano ballad. You're like, okay, I need this. Thank you for coming in now.
It's a shot in the arm.
Yeah. Well, and then, it's followed up by kind of another one, too.
Yeah.
We ready to move on? You got anything more to say about I'm Always in Love?
Stop choking people during...
All right. Next song is Nothing's Ever Gonna Stand in My Way.
Yep.
Again. Any idea what Tony's favorite song on this album is?
This may be it. It's got this album
in its peak. It's
It's in.
In my opinion, it's a, hey, Wilco knows what they're for, and here it is, baby.
Yeah,
these songs in a row here.
Yeah, it's got the hand claps. It's got the drunken synth.
It's got Mellotron.
Yeah.
You know what the song reminds me of?
And his voice is really attractive on
really,
the song.
It really is.
It is.
The backing vocals.
Oh, yeah, they're great. During the bridge, especially, it is very Kinksy. This song is channeling the Kinks in a way that nothing else on the album does.
Yeah, I never thought of that, but you're right, yeah. And I have absolutely no idea what the hell he's talking about. I can't.
Well, I think he's talking to himself again.
He is.
And
he's giving himself,
it sounds like a pep talk.
It sounds like a pep talk. He's giving himself a boost.
But the whole time he's doing it, I feel like he's not believing it.
Well, I think there's probably some truth to that, too.
He does not have a voice to inspire. He has a voice that
He has a limited voice that's extremely expressive.
That's very emotive.
And always appropriate.
Yep.
Yeah. It's kind of like a Tom Waits voice. Tom Waits isn't going to make you want to get up out of your chair and just make the world a better place, even if he sings the happiest lyrics in the world.
Well, Tom Waits makes me want to not be in a bar, not because the lyrics are happy, but because I'm scared of being Tom Waits.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a great song. I love it. But now we're going to a little bit of a complicated song.
Yep.
Pie Holdin' Sweet.
Got some more of your Mellotron in there being used quite a bit. This is a really good headphone
song. It is. I don't know if it works as well as it should work, though. Unlike a lot of songs we've talked about in the past where there are multiple songs joined together, this one feels just slightly
a little
more disjointed. It's a good song. I don't want to knock it, but I think it's better in the second two-thirds, like the last two-thirds of it. The first third is a little disjointed.
Well, and it kind of ends strange. I mean, I like the way that it ends.
Yeah, me too.
It almost seems like they should have stopped the song and like faded the last part in.
I don't know. Look, who am I to say, right? I'm not the one in the production booth. It just listening to it always seems just like it doesn't quite what they were trying to do just doesn't quite hit the mark.
And this is,
I appreciate it sounding different than we get a little break from what we've been through.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's got that trumpet in there, which I believe, and it's got the banjo.
Yep.
And
sucker for the banjo.
I think the trumpet is actually played by the guy from Boy Dog Pondering, Dave Crawford.
Oh, yeah.
Boy Dog Pondering was up in Chicago at that point. So I think that's, yeah.
All right. Next song is an instructional tune, How to Fight Loneliness.
Smile all the time. Shine your teeth till meaningless. And sharpen them with lies. And whatever's going.
I think there's two things about this song that bother me. The way that it starts sounds to me like when you first had, when you were learning bar chords on guitar. And you just start going, oh, I can go down, I can go down, I can go down. And then you get down to the E and you, oh, wow. And it's just not that interesting. And the lyrics are a little sophomoric to me. And it sounds like the rest of the band is trying to polish this turd and they just can't quite do it. Now, I may be very different, but it's just the lyrics are just like smile all the time. It's just, and then the do stuff in the middle of it. That's always a big turn off for me. Like, hey, I can't come up with lyrics here, so I'm going to do a do thingy. And it's just not that compelling. It's my least favorite song in the album. And it's one I think they could have left off it.
Did you ever see Girl Interrupted?
I don't think I did.
Why is this on that soundtrack?
Which is a very powerful movie that I never saw either.
What do you think of this song, Doug?
It's just okay.
Yeah.
I'd written it, I'd been so proud of myself.
No, I think you're right. You got to look at. I mean, this is what we do here, right? You got to look at songs in the context of what surrounds them on the album.
And, yeah.
And I think
he becomes obvious with his lyrics.
Yeah.
For once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it kind of burns them.
Well, I think I think
he keeps saying smile all the time. Smile all the time.
Smile all the time.
That's how you fight loneliness.
So happy.
I think that's
laugh at all the jokes.
I'm going to just say something, and it may not be a popular statement, but Jeff Tweedy is not a great lyricist, and I think what the way he gets around that is being
obscure,
right?
So when he's direct, you don't want to, it's like lifting up the rock and seeing what's going underneath.
Sometimes he comes up with the turn of phrase that's insightful, like the ashtray said,
yeah,
you were up all night.
Yeah, that's a good line.
That's a good line.
He can do it, but I do agree he takes cover in obscurity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and in this song, he doesn't do that very well, and
you get to
see behind the curtain a little bit.
All right, Via Chicago. You know, real quick, Jan, before you say, I want to hear what you have to say, but I just listening to that little clip makes me realize what you said about him being excited about Bennett playing the piano, because the piano just really adds so much to this album.
It really does, and on this song.
This song in particular. It's interesting how the little sort of little things he does on the piano just add.
Yeah, he's always a little bit behind the beat mm-hmm. when he plays, and it's the stuff he does on piano on this album is remarkable. This to me is one of the most compelling songs they have ever written, perhaps the most compelling song, because it's long. There is so much that goes on lyrically and musically on this. I can't tell if it's a complete mess or a masterpiece. I mean, I used to not like it. And the more that I've listened to it, I've come to this has been one of my favorite pieces on the album.
I think there's a little bit of that going on at Wilco for Wilco at this time, that scratching your head about whether or not this is a mess or whether it's a masterpiece. Yeah. Not, I mean, I think that bleeds over into Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Yeah, you know? I think you're right.
It's like there's a...
I think he really liked this and kind of took it, this idea with him to Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Yeah. This song sounds to me just the bass song, not with any of the studio stuff on it, like something tune-wise could have been on an Uncle Tupelo album. And then they layer all this other stuff.
Well, there's parts where the drums completely drop out, and it's just some sort of feedback going on.
I'm talking about like the more acoustic soft stuff that Tweedy was really good at with that band.
That the way that it ends with that kind of distorted cacophony going on behind it, where it's just his voice and that like really tinny guitar, is just, I'm always fascinated by production. And I mean, how do you make one song sound so different in each verse or in a chorus, and then how it ends versus how it begins?
I've always thought that this was one of Jeff Tweedy's favorite songs, and I can't tell you why I think that, but I've just always got that that feeling from it. And this is another one.
I dreamed about killing you again last night. And it felt all right
to me. And the way he sings that, it's so matter of fact.
Yeah. This is based on that. Well, that's murder. What do they call them? Murder stories or something.
It was some book that he had
been reading. It's a genre of...
But he's coming home via Chicago. It's like, is that menacing? Is he like, has he already... committed? Is he about to commit the murder, or is he going to murder?
Hopefully, he's writing about a character.
Yeah, he is,
of course. So. But
again, it's also a little bit of a shock thing, too, right? I mean, you talk about ending "She's a Jar" with that line. You start this song with the thinking about killing.
And
you can
give interviews where you say you're not into shocking people, but too late.
Too late.
Well, and it's the second part of that thought too. That's really like. The part of it, right? Yeah. It felt all right to me.
Well, then but the music behind it is like, what's going through his head? Is he coming to murder you, or has he already done the murder and he's trying to come to a safe place, or you know, what?
Why can't we just have more songs about rainbows and what's on the other side?
All right. ELT.
Boy, did we need this song.
It's a great song.
It's a great song.
It sounds like it should be, every little thing's going to be all right.
Yeah, it does.
Instead of, tears you apart.
I think that's probably intentional.
Well, I know it is. I'm just saying, come on, man. Can't we just be happy one tune? You just killed somebody in the last tune.
If that were the line, I think that would have just made it so cliche. You just would have gone, this is just a cliche, happy...
But would it have been cliche in the middle of the rest of this stuff?
I think he's built some cred with the I'm So Deep crowd.
Yeah.
Yeah. This sounds
like every little thing's going to be all right. It's just perfect. Yeah.
This is another one where Jay Bennett plays almost all the instruments.
And the Mellotron is...
And the Mellotron's very... It. Yeah,
I like the song.
Like the song a lot.
Yeah, and the guitar is. Yeah, it's a great. Really, it's a great. Really,
it's
cool
a great. It's just musically, it's pure pop joy. But then,
it's gonna tear you apart. You're gonna die in your bed.
Yeah. I mean, it's got so much energy, and we needed it. We really needed it.
All right. Well, speaking of energy, My Darling.
Time.
Bop Bop Boss or you jam?
That's yeah, but they don't bother me. They don't bother me because they're in the background. This is the most Beatlesque of the songs, I think, that they've done. It's got that.
I heard Later Day Beach Boys sounds.
Well, I can see that too. But I want to say it's a Jew's harp that's going through this, but I can't. I'm looking at the credits. There's no Jew's harp, but there's some sort of like background.
You want to explain to people what that is?
Jew's harp is an instrument that has a spring on it, and you put it on your mouth, and it
and you boing boing. Yeah,
it's the quintessential hillbilly instrument. It is. It's,
you can't yeah, get I much know. Why is it a juice harp instead of a hillbilly harp?
I don't know.
But yeah, it's that bang 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 thing. So
and it always makes you wonder why is that needed.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but
I'm kind of like you were about one of the songs you mentioned. You're like, it's just kind of there. I feel that way about this song. This is kind of there.
I agree. It's not one of my favorite songs.
And for those of you who, when I said energy, I was being facetious.
Yes, there's not a lot. It's almost a dirge, yeah. Especially with those drums. Just a boom, boom, boom.
Are we there yet?
Yeah.
It's the Are We There Yet song.
It's got a slide bass on it, which I...
Whoa. What's a slide bass?
I think it's a fretless bass that you play with a slide. What's that guy from Presidents of the United States of America used to play that? And the other guy, Morphine, and the lead singer of Morphine used to play a slide bass.
So you're just saying words.
There's that band, Presidents of the United States of America, and there was Morphine was a really good band.
Ladies and gentlemen, please write us if you know what JM's talking about.
Okay, here's our theme song coming up next. When you wake up feeling old.
No, I can't sing till she brings a sound to life. And I blend with kings, we'll never change.
I love that little keyboard.
I like the whole song.
And, I do too.
It's another Beach Boys tune.
It is.
I think of Harry Nilsson when I hear
it
this song.
Like that too. It does sound like Harry Nilsson.
This song.
I think its range might be smaller.
It's got that, but I think what we're hitting on is it's like quintessential mid 60s pop sound.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's got
bop, bop when people weren't scared to go. Bah, bah,
well, it's got that old fashioned that square wave synth going through.
Yeah, it feels like you're just kind of like a jaunt through the park or something. You know,
it's a park song.
It's a great song. I love this song. I love it.
It's one of my favorites on the album.
It sure doesn't sound like 1999.
It does not.
No. If you told me this came out in 1966, I would have totally believed you.
No, it's great.
But when you wake up, well, even the lyrics. Look at the clock telling time.
Up and away, my beautiful.
Is that the, who is that? That's the Fifth Dimension? Yeah.
First. Classic AM radio.
It is. Absolutely. up and away.
That's a good song.
All right. Now we are moving on to what's known in the biz as the title track, Summer Teeth. Another autumn, the traveler's guide. It's news twice before he dies. And every evening when he gets home, to make his supper and eat it alone, his black shirt cries while his shoes get cold. It's just a dream he keeps having. This is Jay Bennett at his best. He's playing the guitar parts and he's playing that
cool piano part, and he's playing those Fender Rhodes sound, and
to me it sounds like we got a little more sophisticated than the rest of the album.
I agree with you there too.
I may have to take back which song is my favorite song. This is the one that I when this pops up I always forget about the little chirpy birds in the background and the music. I agree with you, Doug. This sounds like a step above.
Well, yeah, it starts off with the sea rolling, and it's got the birds in the background, and
everything was great before this, but this just sounds like it.
And this is one of those songs
from above.
Well, it's also one of those songs lyrically that's not like, you know, like the last line is, or one of the last lines is, he feels lucky to have you here in his kitchen in your chair. Sometimes he forgets that you're even there. It's like, and every guy is like that, you know, you're happy. You're with somebody.
Right.
And you take him for granted, not for any other reason other than just that's kind of your personality or who you are or whatever.
I love that line. It's a dream he keeps having. Yeah. It doesn't seem to mean anything. Yeah. I love that line.
It's a great song. Yeah. And the oohs and the ahs are so damn great. And
then how that oohs and ahs kind of, you think that it's ending the song and then it.
And I just love the birds. The bird sounds are so great in it.
Yeah.
When's the last time we had bird songs in a song?
I don't know.
XTC.
Was it? Oh, yeah.
I think that opening.
Yeah, that opening, yeah. It's supposed to be reminiscing of a park, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's a fantastic song. Yeah. It's so good. All right.
And then.
Well, yeah. And then. This song feels a bit like Looking Into the Future. Perfect name for the song. In a Future Age.
So will us all. Let's turn our prayers to outrageous stairs and mark our page in a future age. Have love, see.
I could think of better songs to have ended the album with.
Well, that's why they didn't end it with it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So there's hidden tracks.
Yeah, that's why there's hidden
tracks. You know what? You guys are going to throw something at me, but this sounds to me like where they're headed.
I can hear a little bit of The Cash Machine.
Yeah.
Is something in green. Whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I don't think this is necessary.
It's not.
I think I would have gone. I would have stopped on our.
I would have stopped on Summer Teeth. Well, yeah.
I think it would have been okay to throw Candy Floss in there if you wanted to.
But, you know, I don't think his gift is knowing when to stop.
Well, that's why you put out a double album for your second album.
Yeah. I agree with you on that. Yeah. And he's
even so prolific. Songs. And I'll say this. He is one of the greatest tunesmiths I can think of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm going to say something that I know probably makes people mad, but it seems like they're easy and he has access to hundreds of tunes that he can pull out at any time. I know that may be completely wrong. He may be pounding away in the studio just to get one song, but it seems that easy.
Yeah.
And he's a little bit like Neil Young, where he can't tell when he's being fantastic and when he's being.
I agree with that 100%.
Welfare mothers make better lovers. Yeah.
But so one of the things, but the guy
that just did Heart of Gold think this needs to be on here? I mean, it's bizarre.
Well, again, I think that Jay Bennett comes to the rescue on this because he is doing some really cool stuff on this, on the piano. He's doing that. I mean, this is, even though he's not a virtuoso on the piano, but
he doesn't need to be.
And no, he doesn't need to be.
These songs don't need to be.
Because that's not what the songs are doing. He
does that counterpart, that counter melody that doesn't make, like, he's, everybody else is in one key and he's playing in a totally different
key. When you have such great tunes, you don't need
flash.
Not just flash, but when you take a song like Greensleeves, like, you know, what Ralph Vaughan Williams did with it, he didn't bury it. He just let the song
be. Yeah.
And I feel like
Tweety kind of.
He makes fantastic songs, and he just needs to be really careful not to cover them up. And I know he wants to cover up his lyrics.
Yeah.
But he, these tunes are.
He does write tunes where you can hang a lot of stuff on them.
Oh, I know. And I've already
confessed that I'm a huge fan
of Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. And I love all those weird radio noises and stuff that he does on there.
And one of the things that his gift is, it's like Elton John can't write a song that doesn't, where the piano's not totally featured, you know. And there's guys like Tom Waits that can write songs that he may have written it on the piano, he may have written it on the guitar. You can't tell. you can't tell what the prominent instrument is supposed to be. And I think Jeff Tweedy has a gift for doing that, which can allows the songs
to Well, don't you think all his are written on the guitar?
I don't know. I'm sure. I don't know that you know, he plays bass and he's not that strong a guitar player.
Sometimes a piano player is writing notes and a guitar player is writing chords and thinking notes.
That's interesting. That's interesting. And I bet you're right. I bet he does write most of his songs on guitar. I mean, I've never seen him play anything else besides bass, but nobody writes on bass.
All right. So we've got hidden tracks.
Yes.
And I think the first one is so necessary. The first hidden track is just,
it's just, this is like, hey, we're freaking out.
I'm talking about 23 seconds of silence.
Oh,
that's the first hidden track. Why you even name it is beyond me, but we're not even going to play it. There's the first hidden track is 23 seconds of silence. The second one, though, we are going to play, which is Candy Floss.
That's a good song. Yeah. And even though it's almost 3 minutes long, it's almost a minute of that weird kind of chiming synthesizers that are coming in that are
part
fading
of that
in.
Sounds like not Wilco. I hear the beginnings of another band for a little while. So
what band?
I don't know. It just sounds like
up until that last bit, There's definitely sounds in the song that sound modern, but most of it sounds, again, like the 1960s pop
and
song.
And the way that it ends with that Mellotron voices.
Yeah.
it's probably the most complicated song on the album.
Yeah, it does sound very complicated.
It changes keys several times. And the way that it ends in a totally different key than it started on. It's a compelling song, and why they wanted to bury it, I don't know.
A lot of bands do that. There's a band I've mentioned before on the podcast that I really like, called Super Deluxe, and they buried this just amazing, crunchy 3-minute power pop song as a hidden track on their second album. And
Train in Vain
it's only buried. Hidden because they pressed the label before they.
Oh really?
Yeah. They had already pressed the label before they decided to put that song on there.
Didn't so it they wasn't put a sticker on there.
Yeah, it wasn't intentionally a hidden track. They just I don't know. It's weird,
but it's great song. It's
fantastic.
Yeah, I don't know that they've ever performed it live.
It's got my favorite vocals on the album.
Yeah,
I think.
It does. It's got those
maybe he
harmony
thinks
vocals.
It's a throwaway.
Well, it is kind of bubblegummy, but so what? Who cares?
You gotta be deep.
You gotta be thinking about strangling people, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, bubblegummy people don't have to go to rehab.
That is true. All right. Final song on the album is Shot in the Arm remix version.
Redo.
All right.
Like you said earlier, it's an inferior
version to the one that's. Yeah.
I don't know why they decided they needed to put it on.
I like the lyrics in this one better.
it's an odd thing that
it's tintier or something.
And it absolutely goes to your argument, Doug, about the guy not knowing when to say no or this doesn't need to happen. It's like he's like, well, let's just go ahead. I like this one better for this reason. Let's just go ahead and put it on the album. It doesn't make any sense.
It's what the CD did to musicals.
It's completely unneeded.
It's unneeded. You're right.
I mean, the CD's done a lot.
I mean, I could see having 23 seconds of silence and then putting on.
Would you name it, though?
No, I would not.
23 name seconds it. Of silence.
23 seconds.
Maybe we should go back and play that. All 23 seconds of it.
This is the album where Tweedy starts to get carried away, and he does get carried away in future albums.
Yeah. And every album.
How can you say that when the album before this was 19 tracks?
Yeah, because he gets enamored with sounds.
Okay, maybe carried away studio wise, but he's always been somebody, or at least since being there, somebody who can't edit himself. It seems like.
I agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, this should have been.
That probably plugs into the zeitgeist that's going on in his head.
Well, I wonder.
Inability to.
Like you said,
things out.
He's so prolific. I mean, he's put stuff out. I mean, besides this band, he has that band with his son, and they asked him, they said, well, could these. Why did you make these songs with your son and not with Wilco? He goes, no reason. I just had these songs available, and I just.
It reminds me of Paul McCartney with. So much extra that it's profligate. It's like God. He says, oh, yeah, I'll make a billion galaxies.
Because I can.
And I'm not wasting anything because I make things.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's they've always struck me that way.
So just.
Which is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
I just wonder how many songwriters listen to Wilco say, if I could just have one catchy little tune like they put together.
Yeah.
Well, just real quick before we talk about what happens to the band. So this tells you how committed, and I'm saying that a little tongue in cheek, the label was. They spent $350,000 to promote this album, which is
pittance.
It's nothing.
We spend more than that on one episode.
Yeah. They essentially decided, I don't think they knew how to market this. I think it's very similar to the Jellyfish album.
So this was, we mentioned this earlier, there were some things that were kind of pretending what was to come. There was some friction within the band as a result of this. And
known as band friction.
Band friction.
Something you said, Doug, made me just tonight think about. I wonder how much. I mean, I'm certain. Obviously, this is not. I'm not saying anything like, you know, world breaking or anything about how much Jay Bennett walking around saying how much he contributed to this album bothered Tweedy. But I wonder if part of his issue at the time, and I think he's gone to therapy and rehab and all sorts of stuff. I think he's a better place.
Way different now.
Yeah. Yeah. But I wonder at that point, one of the reasons he pushed Bennett aside is because he couldn't handle having somebody with an ego like that in his band anymore.
Well, another thing that I read was that Bennett was trying to basically take over the whole mixing and the whole production process. And Tweedy just didn't like the way that Bennett would do mixes and didn't like the way that he did the production values and didn't. And he just really liked that Jim O'Rourke guy that they actually got. They've worked with on several albums since.
Well, when did Bennett leave?
He left during the making of Yankee Hotel.
He's on that album.
Yeah.
And I think I think when he dismissed him, Tweedy said, you'll get paid for your contributions, but we got to move on. And I also think, that's around the time Tweedy was struggling with trying to get better, or at least start to get better.
He was trying to get rid of the poison.
Bennett wasn't
trying. No, he was knee deep. And from what I understand, he was the one guy that was like, gimme, 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 you know? And he unfortunately didn't. When did he die?
What year did he die?
He passed away in 2009.
Oh, May of 2009. Okay.
And he had some solo things.
Yeah, and he was before that. He was working.
I've heard some of that. I really liked it.
He was a very talented guy. He needed hip replacement surgery, and supposedly he needed it for a long time.
I forgot about that.
And the insurance company wouldn't pay for it because it was a pre-existing condition. So he was trying to raise money, and he went as far as to sue Wilco for
breach of contract,
something like that. And I think while that was being litigated, he died in his sleep.
He's one of those guys that when you read about him by people who are in the industry, they're like, boy, what could have been? Mm-hmm. It's so sad, you know?
Yeah.
So this is the moment when we give our ratings for the album we've discussed. And as we like to always remind people, we give two ratings. We give one that is our personal rating, i.e. how much we like the album, how much we'll be willing to listen to it again. And then we give a critical rating, which is to pull all that aside and just look at it in the vacuum of what it represents critically, you know, taking all of our emotions out of it. So I'm going to go to Doug first, since he didn't pick this album. Doug, what say you?
I'm going to say 4.7 on both. And we're talking about one of the most talented tune creators I can think of. And we're talking about an imaginative production. So that's where I go with it. I don't have anything bad to say about it.
Okay.
I'm not as much of a Wilco. I discovered in this process, I thought I was really into Wilco, and then I discovered I was really into Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, A Ghost Is Born, and Kicking Television, and didn't realize how much I had not listened or paid attention to the earlier records.
Including this one?
Well, of the earlier records, I've listened to this one the most.
Yeah.
But not... I can remember a period of time where I think I listened to Yankee Hotel Foxtrot almost every day for months.
Wow.
I just was stuck on it. And none of the rest of, a lot of the rest of Wilco is intriguing to me, but not addictive the way that was. And as I said earlier, I finally got to the point with, this nihilism is going to kill me if I keep listening to it. And I just went cold on him almost overnight. So I still have great respect for him. I still enjoy listening to their music, but I just can't take it in large doses.
I get that.
Because it's a sad place.
Well, it's like when we were listening to Nick Drake.
It's the same deal.
There's
same
only so deal. Much you've, yeah. of that you can wallow in. Okay, well, I'm going to go to me next. I was a little surprised in doing this and going back and listening to Being There, how much I had disparaged that album unfairly. So why I'm saying that is I think I may give Yankee Hotel Foxtrot another try or two. I haven't listened to it since we did it, just because it was a bit of a chore for me, and maybe it wouldn't be. I think,
well, this time it won't be fighting against one of your buddies.
Well, yeah, and we've talked about me being a side picker, but I think that I think this podcast, and we've talked about this before, has morphed me into being significantly more tolerant about music that I.
That's well, that. I'll tell you what, that is so true. Even though you're the one that's supposed to be talking right now, I started listening to all of Steely Dan's albums.
Yeah,
and I've hated Steely Dan. Hard, like I can't push the button fast enough to change the channel. And this podcast has turned me into someone that's so curious about things I don't know.
You sent us a text the other day that said you might have been wrong about Yes, and I almost dropped my phone when I read that.
I tell you what, man, this exercise that we're doing is really valuable.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that because I want to give it another listen. I'm not going to quite give this personally the accolades Doug did. I'm going to give it a 4.0. It's a great pop album, but I think because it's not coming from necessarily a bass pop line sensibility, there's some things about it that just kind of rub me the wrong way about that stuff. But I still enjoy it tremendously. There's a couple of songs that I could give or take, but most of it I like. Critically, I'm going to say it's a 4.5. I mentioned this earlier. I think this was a brave album for this band to make. It's really sad that it didn't. That it took the next album for them to kind of get their breakthrough, and I think
to get their teeth into it.
Yeah, but I think the unfortunate thing about that is it's not. Sometimes I wonder if it's not so much the music as how that album was created that gave them the bump. Well, regardless, people got into it.
Yeah,
but it's a shame that people don't that it took so long for this album to be something that people, because it's worthy of listening to. It's definitely worthy of listening to. All right, Jam.
All right. So I'm going to kind of echo something that Doug said. I think that Jeff Tweedy is one of the greatest tunesmiths in the world, and he is like Tom Petty to me. But it just seems so effortless for Tom Petty to write a song. It seems almost effortless for Jeff Tweedy to just come up with a tune. I think Tom Petty's a better lyricist, but I'm always intrigued by what Jeff Tweedy is doing. That's going into my personal rating. It's a 4 or 5. And the reason why I give it a 4 or 5, I would have given it a higher rating, but there's albums that I like more by Wilco. This is probably my second or third favorite album of theirs. Yankee Hotel Foxtrot is definitely my favorite. In fact, it's one of my all-time favorite albums ever made. But it's just a gorgeous album, and it's just got so much pop sensibility. And I know that the lyrics sometimes can be downers, but when I first heard this album, I could not stop listening to it. And I would say this was probably in my CD player the most in 1999 and 2000.
I think its picture is next to the definition of pop sheen.
It's got there's some elements of late 60s sound. It's got some Beatlesque moments to it. It's just everything are just relatively like little pop gems, you know. Critically, I'm going to give it a 4 or 5 as well. I'm like most critics. I mean, almost most critics that have listened to this album give it one of the best albums of the 90s. And even though it came out in...
just in time.
Yeah, just in time.
For 99. Y2K.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Destroyed Earth.
This is a great introduction to Wilco because it does give you a really good idea of maybe not the first two albums.
Yeah, but that's why it's a good introduction.
It's a good introduction to them because you're not going to hear anything like that.
This is where they become Wilco.
This is where they're Wilco. The first two albums are sort of an anomaly based on where they were before, or where Tweedy was before, where his headspace was.
And there are people that have asked me, what's the Wilco album you should listen to? And this is the one I usually tell them to start with.
Because speaking from experience, you don't want to hand them out Yankee Hotel Foxtrot and say, go have fun.
Yeah, go have fun with this one.
Well, that's what JM did to me.
But you're a different person. Yeah, you're a stronger person than I am, Doug.
That's right.
So we've come to the part of the show where Tony gives us a recommendation. We like to find out what the kids are listening to, or he's got his ear to the ground. What's hot? What's new? What's happening? What's good?
He's the American Bandstand.
Yes.
So, guys, I'm gonna talk about an album by an Austin band called Gleason. They're the brainchild of there's a label here called Almost There, and their founder Ty Chandler formed this band, I think, around 2008. Their first, it's mainly him, a couple other musicians. They're definitely, I think they've played live, but they're definitely more of a studio band. And their first album was called The Best of Gleason, which I find very funny. And the second one's called Gleason 2 in the vein of Queen. And it's here's where my hypocrisy comes in. It's a double album. But the reason I'm recommending it is that it feels to me like the album we talked about tonight. It's definitely comes from a pop foundation. So it's much more pop, like through line is much more pop oriented. But just the fact that the studio stuff and everything just reminded me of that album. So it feels a lot like Summer Teeth. So I just wanted to play a couple of things for you guys just so you can get a hang of what it sounds like. The first song I'm going to play is called Queen of Boulevards. That's a little taste of that.
Wow, I really like that.
That sounds more like Jellyfish.
Yeah, it does.
I don't know.
That is so good.
And then, the next song I'm going to play is called "Wasted in a Dream." And then the final song I'm going to play is called Right There Along. anyway.
That's really good stuff.
Gleason 2, Austin Band. We'll put a post to or link to the album on this from this episode, so you can go to, I think it's available on Amazon or Bandcamp. We'll put a post to link to their Bandcamp page, so you can check that out and some of the other stuff they've done as well since then.
So, Tony, thank you very much for that recommendation. And, Tony, why don't you give us some information about the new tagline that we're asking our listeners to participate in.
Yeah. Thank you, JM. So, we had mentioned this on a couple episodes ago, and there'll be some information on the website as well. But what we're asking is for our loyal listeners to come up with a tagline. Right now, our tagline is Short Talks About Long Players, which is a brilliant tagline, but no longer appropriate. We are very long, and we want to reflect that. So if you can come up with something pretty snappy, we will send you a shirt or a trucker hat. We have both, your choice. If we pick your tagline as our new tagline, and we really appreciate. So we've gotten some suggestions already. I'm not going to comment on whether they're great or not. They're great, but we've got to determine a winner, and we want to give people
a chance. We're not biased.
Yeah.
And we'll mention your business on the air.
Anyway, so yeah, just if you can, we'll, like I said, there'll be a way to get from the website to get those suggestions to us.
All right. Thank you for that valuable information, Tony. And thanks for letting us fill your airwaves with another episode of This is Vinyl Tap, the podcast that always goes to 11. If you know anyone that likes the long player format, please let them know about this podcast. And we're available on most podcasting platforms. And while you're there, please leave us a review or give us some stars. We're always looking for some feedback. And you can reach us via Twitter at Tapping Vinyl, or you can visit our Facebook group page, which is becoming increasingly popular these days, it seems.
Yeah,
lots of activity.
Lots of activity up there. And also, if you're old school like I am, you can email us at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But of course, for the ultimate This is Vinyl Tap experience, please visit our website. You're going to find all sorts of good stuff up there. You'll find links to past episodes, information about some of the artists we've talked about, and people we've recommended. So please go up there, and you can also contact us there as well.
You can look at our picture and see if we look like what you thought we were. Yeah, that's
right. Faces for radio.
go check out our photo and find out why we're not on YouTube.
That's right.
Next week is a listener pick album, a bastion, if you will, of the glam rock era, T-Rex Electric Warrior. Our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe. This is Vinyl Tap, where all the podcasts go to 11. And hey, what does the ashtray say about you?
Up next, Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
Oh, I'm hosting, I thought.
Up next.
How would I be hosting?
This is his album.
Because I was looking that way.
Test.
Sibilance.
Everything's
so it'll pop. I noticed that sounded better with the sing on. Yeah, there we go. Test.